Hi, this is Josh Levine, the host of Slate Sports Podcast, Hang Up and Listen. Throughout the World Cup, we're going to bring you a podcast from our friends at the soccer magazine Howler. They'll have analysis from the games, news from outside the stadiums in Brazil, and reports from a writer embedded with the U.S. national team. I hope you enjoy this special podcast extra, and I'll now pass the mic to George Qureshi, the founder and editor of Howler. Take it away, George.
Hello and welcome to Dummy, a twice weekly conversation among editors and friends of Howler magazine. My name is George Qureshi. I'm the editor of Howler. Packed like a little sardine in this studio. Although, you know what? I have a lot of room today because Danny Carbassian, the only member of our little panel here who has scored a goal for Arsenal still, if you can believe that, is in South Carolina in someone's closet so he can get really a quiet feed here. Danny, how are you?
I'm doing very well. Thank you.
Hello. Okay. And, joining us from Bristol, England, not Connecticut, is the author of The Ball Is Round and Futebol Nation. It's a great book about Brazilian soccer that just came out. David Goldblatt. Hi, David.
Hi.
Hello. Okay. I feel really chipper today because we haven't had any soccer for at least a day. And I think I'm getting worn down by it. But, there's so much stuff to talk about. Today, we're going to cover some of the issues and themes that came out in the quarterfinals. We have the Dutch diving, the Dutch gamesmanship. We have the Argentines squeaking through, the Brazilians making it through, albeit with a depleted lineup for the semifinal against Germany. And of course, Germany, I think they should just give Germany a free pass to the semifinals every year. That just seems to be what happens anyway. So we're going to also take the conversation off the field. We have a look at the socioeconomic and racial makeup of the crowds in Brazil, which I think is really interesting. We also sit down with Sean Jacobs, a professor at the New School for Public Engagement in New York City. He's the founder and editor of the blog and media collective Africa is a Country. We talk about the collapse of the Nigerian FA and the Ghanaian FA, the issues there, and some of the other things that came out when the African teams were struggling, and maybe in Algeria's case and Nigeria's case succeeding to an extent in this tournament. Another really busy show. Let's start with the quarterfinals. David, Danny, I want to talk about the Dutch. You know, here's the thing. Whenever people talk about gamesmanship and diving and complaining and whining, they always focus on Latin American teams. And I don't think that's fair because by far the most annoying team in this World Cup has been the Dutch. Am I wrong about that?
I mean, I think they're definitely an interesting team to watch because, as you said, most Latin teams get the brunt of the abuse for diving and everything. And I think Arjen Robben, to point out one player in particular, his reputation.
He's a Dutch master at diving. He's so good.
Yeah, he is very good. And what's bad now is that actually every time he does get tackled, even if it's a fair tackle and he was just kind of going over, it's everybody immediately says, like, well, I have to see the replay first, which is a bit of a shame, to be completely honest, because of how good of a player he is. But yeah, it is. It does put a little bit of a tarnish on the game, especially because, as I said, the number of times now, you know, every time he does get in and around the box, and there's a situation where a couple players are around him and he goes down, there's always way more attention when Robin's at the middle of it.
Well, is it a tarnish? Because, you know, Robin, the style of his play is to get the ball and go directly at defenders, which I really like. I think it's exciting. It's direct. It's really it causes problems for most defenses. And you know what? A lot of times he is taken down pretty violently, and I think he deserves a fair amount of protection. At the same time, you know, it doesn't bother me that he dives. I don't mind it. In the same way that I don't mind Luis Suarez's antics, like, you know, the racism aside.
I mean, if I can say, I just think, you know, if you're going to be theatrical, it's just so unbearably cheesy that the way that he dives, the kind of the wailing and the extended sort of, you know, facial expressions. And I just think, you know, play it a little calmer if you're going to play it.
Well, you'd think he'd practice, you know, this stuff, right? Because you it's a part of your game plan, dude. Practice diving. Get better at it.
I'll say one thing, and and I don't know, I guess maybe referees just aren't, I mean, I'm sure they're attuned to this, but whenever you see a player go down and roll five times, he's generally not hurt. And when you see a player that's legitimately hurt get hurt, they don't move. The way, you know, when Neymar took the knee to the back this weekend, he just lay there on his stomach, essentially, until he was escorted off the pitch. And the guys that do end up diving always end up doing three or four, you know, cartwheels and rolls and end up about 15 yards away from where they were actually fouled. And unfortunately, that happens quite often with Robin.
Well, and I think, and then, you know, players are being left unattended when they actually need to be attended to, you know, which I think is also a problem.
Well, that's been...
On the other hand, you know, with Robin, you've got to give the man his due. The balance of his movement is so fine. He's so kind of absolutely on a kind of knife edge as he moves at that speed. You know, he is going to get, and as you say, he's running right at defenders. He is going to get caught. He is going to get fouled a lot. So, you know, we should just bear that in mind. That said, the theatricals are excessive at times.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I don't take anything away from his ability on the ball. I think the fact that you do have to watch the replay to see if he was actually hit or not also says volumes about him too, because the way he moves and the way he changes direction so quickly, like you're actually not sure. And even some of the defenders don't think they're going to get him, and then they end up getting him because he changes direction so quickly.
Yeah. You know, we have finally goal line technology to see if a ball went. And I think probably the next step is offside technology, I would imagine. And then they've already started putting linesmen. I don't know what you would call them. They're not refs. They're not
assistant referees is the technical term these days.
At the end of the field. So these guys have no frame of reference for looking at offside at all. Their sole purpose, it seems to me, is to tell the referee if there was a foul in the box.
Yeah.
So I guess maybe that'll be something that changes this. I want to talk about the refereeing in general. It feels to me like it's been too lax. We've had injuries to Neymar, to Di Maria. I think that the Nigerian team was really harmed by Mark Geiger's lack of calling fouls against France in their, what was that, round of 16 match.
And then, what about Brazil-Colombia?
Brazil-Colombia.
54 fouls?
Yes. But at the same time, the referee didn't really, you know, Thiago Silva got a yellow card for doing his stupid blocking of the goalkeeper thing. But then it felt to me like he wasn't really taking control of the game, calming things down, protecting players. And I felt like that was wrong. And also Tim Krul, you know, I don't mind him playing mind games and him getting in the heads of those Costa Rican penalty kick takers. But it seemed to me like, why was the referee letting him sort of prance around the penalty area like that and talk to the kickers? You don't see that very often. Why was he doing that?
Yeah, well, he's about 6'4", and would you want to stand in front of him? I think is partly the explanation. I think maybe the referees weren't, you know, the referee wasn't aware initially he was doing it. I don't know. What actually is the rule? I'm interested to know what the interpretation of the rule is. That considered in some technical sense foul play?
Let's look that up and get back to people after this, because I'm not totally sure. But I don't think that there's any rule against the goalkeeper coming up and talking to the kicker.
But I also think it's an unwritten rule that, you know, I think it happens all the time where a goalkeeper tries to get in the head of the kicker, but the referee generally doesn't let the guy just sit there and have a conversation with them and then say, okay, like, are you done? Go back to your line. So
that's true. But, you know, Chris Jones had a really great piece for, I believe it was ESPN, where he wrote that, you know what? The penalty kick shootout is so stacked against goalkeepers. He made this point, like, you know, if a player receives the ball in the box, turns and shoots, the muscle memory, the practice, it takes over. And the player's going to hit the target 99% of the time, probably put it in a pretty good spot at this level. These players are world-class players. The only thing that makes a penalty kick hard is that walk to the ball, the fact that there's, you know, the expectation that they're going to score, and the huge consequences of missing. And so it becomes, you know, he mentions a hole in golf. I don't know what this hole is, but there's apparently a famous hole in golf where there's a pretty big size green 100 yards out from the tee, but it's in the middle of a huge lake. And that lake is the thing that makes it really difficult for golfers to, you know, pro elite golfers to make this shot consistently. And it's the same thing for penalty kicks. So Krul basically getting in the heads of these players is giving him a better chance of saving this goal. He know, you know, the ball, he knows that the psychology is really the only thing on his side.
Yeah, it is. And I think you, when you look at the Dutch penalties too, though, unfortunately, I think the gamesmanship side of that whole penalty shootout kind of grabbed all the headlines. And I read that article that you mentioned, and it was an excellent article. But it also took away from the fact that the Dutch penalties were all excellent. as well. You know, perfect. I mean, Navas dove the right way for several of them, but the Dutch penalties were so good. And if you do your job and the odds are in your favor, you know, if you put it where you need to put it, then it's going in. But Krul did do a good job of getting in their heads. And I read that he'd, he actually knew before the game that if it did go to penalties, that he would be called into action. And Cillessen actually didn't know that. So, Louis van Gaal, I guess, you know, when you talk about tactics and thinking ahead, it's pretty awesome when you think about it, because he didn't want his number one keeper thinking, oh, well, I'm coming off because there's a better goalkeeper than me when it comes to penalty shootouts. So he was actually kind of perturbed when he did come off. And when Krul went on, he was just buzzing. He was filled with confidence. And I read another article saying that the Costa Rican players and the Costa Rican manager, when they saw Krul get up to warm up, they all kind of like looked around and they said if they could have captured those looks, it would have been hilarious, because they were like, what the heck is going on here?
Yeah, I think, you know, the biggest mind game was probably just putting in a new keeper, right? I mean, that just, any change like that sort of puts the Costa Rican team on the back foot and makes them think, wait, is this guy really good? Is he better than what, you know, the goalkeeper we couldn't score on for 120 minutes, you know, that's a game.
Yeah.
Hey, George, I just want to ask you about the penalties. Isn't it true that kind of intimidation and that getting in somebody's head constantly is going on all across the pitch all the time? It's going on in both boxes, defenders and attackers having a go at each other. And we just don't see it as much because in the melee of action, the cameras are not focused, but we see it when the penalties are taken.
You know, in my days as a youth, elite youth soccer player, it didn't happen quite as much, but I bet Danny can answer that question. He's played at a slightly higher level.
David, I'll say that it does go on. There's plenty of, you know, trash talking. It was spoken about last week, going on a lot of, you know, jersey tugging and all that sort of stuff. But when in a penalty shootout where players are actually allowed to think now and not rely on muscle memory and not allowed just on their sheer ability here, where they're walking up to the ball, they know the entire world is fixated on this one moment to see what they're going to do. That's when it changes a little bit. You know, when there's 22 players involved and you know, there is a lot of action going on and off the ball, it's a bit of a different story than when you're walking, all the cameras are pointed at you. You know, your entire nation's hopes rest on your shoulders, and there's one man and a goal that you need to beat. So,
now the semifinals, Brazil, Germany. This is a huge match. Germany hasn't seemed to play all that well up to now. It's not sort of crushed anyone the way it did Portugal. Are they favorites now that Neymar and Thiago Silva are out for this game?
I think so. I mean, I think it's a tough one actually, because Germany have an extremely talented team, and they're once again in the semifinals. They're extremely efficient. This team is extremely tactically and technically excellent. And Brazil have massive losses with Neymar and Thiago Silva. I think I was watching ESPN the other day, and the guys were saying like what a massive loss Thiago Silva is, but at the same time, Dante is not that bad of a player either, is he? He's a Champions League winner and Bayern Munich's. One of Bayern Munich's top guys when it comes to defense. So I think he'll slide in for Thiago Silva. And then it's a matter of figuring out what they do in the midfield with Neymar not there. And Germany's midfield is extremely, as we said, technical. They're able to keep the ball. They're able to put those passes in between lines and really attack when they want. Whether or not Brazil play an extremely ultra defensive midfield where they have the four in the back and then three kind of holding guys and then their attack, or if they decide to play Oscar kind of in the middle there and have a little bit more of a creative option. But Neymar will be a huge miss in terms of creating things going forward. David mentioned in our first episode, he said what Brazil lack is a playmaker here, and taking Neymar out of the equation as well, I think will make it even more difficult for them.
David, the other semifinal is Argentina-Netherlands, game of really two superstars, and I might be doing Van Persie a disservice here, but it's really Robin has been the key player for the Netherlands, and then of course Messi for Argentina. That said, Aguero apparently is fit for this match, and the English league for providing all of these great club teams has not been all that influential in this World Cup. There was a Barney Rone piece in the Guardian about this. Could he be the savior for the Premier League?
But, you know, that said, when you say two stars and that, you know, Argentina is all Messi, watching that, watching the quarterfinal, that team works so hard. There's one star and then there's kind of 10 workhorses that make that team work. And yeah, I mean, he makes the difference. Even for the goal, he didn't score it, but his move in midfield to actually make the goal was central. But the rest of the team is working so incredibly hard together. And I kind of think actually that's what might, you know, if they can have that and the moment from Messi, I slightly make them the favorite for the for this semi-final.
Okay, let's take a quick break. Next up, we're going to look at the aftermath of the U.S. team's escape from the group of death and then demise in the round of 16, what it means for the players and the future of Major League Soccer. So the World Cup is over for the U.S., but there's still a lot happening in the aftermath. We have two players in particular who seem to have caught the eye of big European teams, if you can believe the press reports. DeAndre Yedlin linked with Roma, I believe, and maybe Liverpool. Danny, have you heard about this?
I have. I saw the Roma link for sure. I hadn't seen Liverpool, but this time of the year is quite crazy when it comes to transfer rumors. Right. So you never know what to believe.
The other one is Beasler. Matt Beasler played in the center of the U.S. defense. You know, I find it a little bit ironic that the U.S. didn't have a great tournament altogether. I don't think that any player stood out. The defense in particular created a lot of problems for Tim Howard that he had to clean up. We talked about that in an earlier edition of this podcast. Why is it the defenders who seem to be the most desirable coming out of this?
Well, I think it's that is
we watched them at it quite a lot.
We did.
They got a lot of airtime, though.
Exactly. I think that's probably the reason, is because you know, we didn't have too much, and this is going to sound harsh, but we didn't have too much going forward in our attack, and I think we ended up with like the second to last in number of attacks in the World Cup, so that didn't help out, but. As David just said, we did get to see a lot of them, and their pros and their cons. And, you know, these European teams look at this, obviously, it's a massive growing market here, especially in terms of getting, I don't want to say relatively cheap players, but you can get players that are kind of for the future and guys that you take a gamble on and then hope for the best. So, no, it's good. It's great to see, you know, the World Cup ends and we're all kind of disheartened about the fact that our team's gone out. But then it also revitalizes you to see that there are European teams kind of interested in bringing these guys over. So that's great for U.S. soccer.
One thing that we do a lot over here in the U.S. is talk about the health of our soccer league in a way that I don't think you do. You don't need to in England. I mean, and it's cast in a different light there,
well,
you know.
I disagree. I mean, I think we do talk about it, but we're dealing with the pathologies and the illnesses of excess and affluence.
That's right.
It's a different kind of problem. I mean, if you measure the health of English football by the turnover of the Premiership, then sure, everything is rosy. But you've got to see it in a more kind of complex light than that.
So, and it's funny because I think most American fans want MLS to become more like the Premier League, you know, better players, more money, you know, TV deals. Danny, would you say that this, or David, you as well, was there an effect of this World Cup on MLS? I mean, I think that beyond just the fact that there will be X number of the people who tuned in and sort of saw what soccer could be, will be interested in pursuing their fandom from here, or, you know, but just on the field, players, will players move abroad? Is that a good thing?
Yeah, I think, I mean, the one big thing, and we discussed this earlier, I think the one big thing about the World Cup in the U.S. is we fight two battles. We fight the battle of the actual national team and how they do, and then the battle of growth of soccer in the United States. And the amount of press, once again, that the U.S. national team got going into this tournament, while at the tournament, and even in their exit, you know, all the guys have been doing television appearances since we got eliminated, it'll only help, and it'll create more of a culture where kids see that they can actually play the game, go to MLS, and then actually get a big money move to Europe. You know, before, I think it was all about, I just want to get to Europe now. Maybe kids would do it and it wouldn't be the best of options, and they find themselves coming back to MLS in a tricky situation a couple years later. Whereas now the league has become more and more competitive, and you know, the guys that did stand out, those two names that you said, DeAndre Yedlin and Matt Beisler, those guys both play in MLS and they do well here. So you know, if you take a look at the tournament and see that those two guys have been linked to big moves overseas, and those guys were the two most successful, that's great to see for the league here.
Well, yeah, but I mean, at the same time, Jermaine Jones and Fabian Johnson also had pretty good tournaments, and they play abroad. And I just don't think there's as much excitement just because, you know, Jones is older, the same way Kyle Beckerman's older. I think if he were a 24-year-old, he would be getting a lot more attention for his performance. Okay, all MLS players are back with their teams except one, Julio Cesar for Brazil. He's MLS's great hope to win a World Cup. He would be the first current MLS player to do that. And so I guess if you're rooting for MLS, you're rooting for Brazil in that sense. I think that they have a tough road to the final and to the trophy, but it's going to be pretty fascinating. We're going to hear from Alex Abnos now. He is our editor with Howler. He spent the World Cup embedded with U.S. Soccer as ussoccer.com's writer. Here's Alex.
Hey, how's it going? This is Alex Abnos coming to you from Brazil. I'm actually in a bus station in Rio de Janeiro right now. I'm about to board an all-night bus to Belo Horizonte for the semifinal, but I'm not here to talk about that. I'm here to talk about the United States men's national team exit from the World Cup and kind of what comes next for them. Looking back on that whole experience with the team and the whole run and how their post-game mood contrasted with their post-game mood after the Belgium game, I'd say the Belgium game, it was definitely much more silent than usual. And, you know, you can interpret that a number of ways. You can say that, you know, it was silent because they knew that there was this huge opportunity in front of them that they didn't take advantage of, which I would say is partially true based on comments both from Matt Beisler and Omar Gonzalez. They said as much in their post-game comments. But then also, you know, silence because I think they were all trying to kind of soak in the moment. You know, this was their last moments as a participating nation in this World Cup. And I think it was a very transformative experience for a lot of members of the squad. You know, some players will go on and maybe have huge career advancements because of their performances in the World Cup. For some of them, it'll be their last World Cup, and for some of them, it might be their only World Cup. So I think a lot of them, you know, were kind of coming to terms within themselves with the fact that they were not in the tournament anymore and sort of what this means for them going forward, which is different for everybody. As for the players themselves, what they do next, they kind of have to move on quickly. Immediately after the game, the team left. They flew back to their Sao Paulo home base. They had the morning in Sao Paulo. They had a team dinner and a team photograph with staff and coaches. And then almost immediately afterwards, it was time for some of them to leave. And it wasn't as if there was one mass exodus and everybody said goodbye at the airport. One by one, the team members left and went to, you know, various places. Some of them had a vacation. Some of them had to get back with their teams. It really depended on where they played, in MLS or in Europe, and that kind of thing. As for what kind of impact that this USA performance will have on American soccer, I don't think that's the kind of thing you can really know until at least a couple years after the fact. Right now, it's all too fresh. I think the United States did make a big statement by getting out of the group of death, a group that many people didn't expect them to get out of. But at the same time, they've also set that bar at that level. Now the U.S. is going to be expected to get out of their group no matter what. So the next step after that is being able to get out of the round of 16 no matter what. And I think it'll be a while before we reach that point. And I think in time, you know, this is just myself talking, I think in time we'll look back on the 2014 World Cup and that Belgium game as the first time the U.S. was really disappointed to not advance past the round of 16. It used to be that up until this point, anything past the round of 16 was gravy. Now I think, you know, we saw a team in Belgium that we had a chance to beat, that we matched up well with. And even though Belgium was very dominant at that game in a lot of spots, and Tim Howard is to thank for a lot of it, I think that a lot of the players felt we still had a chance to win. And they were very disappointed that we couldn't go on. And I think this might be the first time when we can really say that we can have a legitimate disappointment in that regard. And how historically significant is that? Who knows? But it is, I think, the big takeaway from this World Cup. Anyway, that's all for me. I have to go catch this bus and hopefully, maybe, possibly get some sleep on it, perhaps. This is Alex Abnos signing off from Brazil.
Okay, time for another quick break. Next up, we're taking this discussion off the field. We'll be joined by Sean Jacobs, one of the people behind the media collective Africa is a Country, to talk about the problems facing African soccer and the performance of African teams in this World Cup. I'm joined now by Sean Jacobs. Sean is a professor at the New School teaching a class about international soccer and politics. And you are a native of Cape Town. You live, obviously, in the States now, in New York City. And I really want to talk to you about the African teams in this tournament. There were five. None are left, obviously. And I think that they provided some of the most interesting, not only play on the field, because I think in some cases they were very good, especially, you know, Nigeria, Algeria. I think Ghana had some very nice moments, but also some storylines off the field that I think may have been puzzling to a lot of people who aren't all that familiar with African football, African politics, African society. What do you find most compelling here? What do you want to talk about first?
If you want to start, like the thing with the Ghanaian football team and their spectacular meltdown, the way that they played in 2010 and then in 2012, they normally people don't associate Ghanaian football with fights over money or troubles within their camp, and yet they had this major meltdown. In contrast, you had Nigeria. There was talk of a fight over money when players didn't want to practice, but then it went away, and Nigeria actually seemed to have things under control, and I can say something later as to why that's the case. And then you had Cameroon with the meltdown on the field, probably one of their most experienced players who plays for Barcelona, Song, punching another player, you know, in the back.
Right. Asu Okoto also, you know, headbutted his teammate on the field. So let's talk about Ghana first. Ghana has a great soccer tradition, very successful in youth World Cups. You know, obviously they've been troublesome for the U.S. team in years past. And they started the tournament really well. You know, they nearly beat the U.S. Then they held Germany to a draw. They could have gotten through with a result against Portugal, but we saw before that game some drama, some of the veteran players holding out, causing trouble in camp, perhaps reacting to trouble that we didn't see, and the team as a whole demanding a boatload, I guess in this case a plane load of cash in order to keep playing.
The thing about Ghana is like the obvious way to read it is, oh, you know, ill-disciplined, unpatriotic players, prima donnas who want money, and then the sort of the two villains are now Sudi Montari, who plays in Italy, and Kevin Prince-Boateng of Schalke. That's usually how most people experience it. You know, people running around chasing people with broken bottles. I think Montari chased somebody with a broken bottle. But if you step back, then what you realize is these are about not so much about whether these players are being dramatic. This is more about how football is being run in Ghana. Boateng gave an interview right after he was suspended talking about the preparations that they went to the U.S. to have a camp in the U.S. They flew from Amsterdam. And what is normally, I think, like a 7-hour flight turned into a 19-hour flight, sitting in airports, traveling in two groups, finding that the president of the Ghanaian FA and his wife are sitting in first class with their children, sleeping in waterlogged hotels, just terrible preparations. And then on top of it, the question with money, that's just a longstanding problem, I think, with players and bonuses, where players feel they don't get paid. And again, we have to say it's not like Africans are unique in this regard. The first group of players to refuse to play in a World Cup because of bonuses was actually Germany in 1974. But in the case of Ghana, I think these are more structural issues with how the FA is governed.
What is wrong with the Ghanaian FA, and why are the players rebelling against it?
To step back again, and it's a general problem of all FAs, but then it takes on a peculiar or a specific way that it plays out in Ghana. Governments can't fire FAs because FAs are, in terms of the FIFA constitution, there should be no government interference. In some cases, FAs do fine. They govern football, there's enough checks and balances. But in instances where there aren't other institutions to counterbalance, say, how football is run, you end up with somebody running football for sometimes two decades. And this, again, here, Africa's not unique. In South America, you have Grondona running Argentina's football, I think, since 1978. But The Ghanaian FA is run by Kwesi, I forget his name, Nyantakyi, who is currently being accused of match fixing by a British newspaper, where he apparently, in secret recordings, gave promises to fix a game. Secondly, when they went to Brazil, they took an entourage. There were stories about like who's paying for these people, how they were chosen. The person that Sule Montari fought with, he's a club official of one of the leading clubs in Ghana. He's not a technical advisor. What is he doing on the trip?
I see.
People never get paid their bonuses. So I think in a way what happened with the Ghanaian team is frustration over preparation, and Boateng talks about that, mixed with a history of not ever getting paid. I think what happened here was all that came to a head, and the players were like, you know what, this is the biggest stage to embarrass the Ghanaian FA and the people who are running it. Unfortunately, now that the tournament is over, they held a press conference, and their line is kind of players like Montari and Boateng, they are unpatriotic, not disciplined, and that the coach is going to, you know, stay on.
Let's talk about a country very close geographically to Ghana that had a very different set of circumstances that it was playing under. Nigeria, when the Nigerian team was playing through the group stage, there were two instances of shootings at viewing parties in the northern part of the country. Now, I know that Boko Haram has been a huge problem in Nigeria. For people unfamiliar, that's the group that took those girls, and they've been doing, besides that, a bunch of other really terrible things to people who live in northern Nigeria. Sean, to what extent is this a soccer problem? Because I suspect that it's really, you know, sort of a different problem that, you know, a host of African nations face with a weak central government trying to keep the edges together, seeping into soccer.
I think maybe with fans, but less so with the national team, because most of the players play in Europe. Camps can be held in, and in the preparations for like the World Cup, they were mostly held in Europe, in Britain specifically, and then in America. And then they went down to Brazil. So I'm not sure how the team was affected, but I think the Nigerian team, interestingly, had a different fate. But my sense was that Stephen Keshi...
Now, he's the coach. He's the first African coach to bring an African team through the group stage.
Yeah, so you had... I think what Stephen Keshi did really successfully was to sort of insulate the team from all these other goings-on, where the Nigerian FA is subject to political intrigue, which is sort of tangentially related to the troubles in the north. But like, who's running football? Is it a northerner? Is it a southerner? Are they close to the minister of sport? Are they opposed to the minister of sport? Do they have the ear of the president? And as I said in the beginning, FIFA doesn't really care about that. His own troubles with them, with the Nigerian FA that didn't pay him, that wants to interfere in how the team gets picked, he did really well to keep them out of it. So they kept that going up until the round of 16 match right before they played Argentina, when you saw news emerging that players had refused to practice because they didn't get paid.
I want to ask you one final thing. It's about Yaya Toure's comments that nobody was sad that the Ivory Coast went out of the tournament because they're African. What do you make of that? Do you think it's true? And also, I mean, to what extent does sort of the reception of these teams in the rest of the world matter in terms of not just a sporting sense, but to these players emotionally? I mean, they're going to be playing in the next World Cup. There will be five African teams playing in one of the most racist societies in the world, Russia, right? We see stories coming out all the time of racism there, especially in the soccer arena. What do you make of those comments?
I think he's right, but I also think that Cote d'Ivoire's team has to take some blame itself for lack of tactics in that match. On the question of Russia, Yaya Toure himself actually a couple of months ago said that African players, black players, should just boycott the World Cup in Russia because of the racism there. Most probably Yaya Toure is not going to be in that World Cup.
Right.
You know, neither will be his brother or Drogba. So it will be a different team, including some players who do play in Russia, in the Nigerian team and so on. So, I mean, I can't say what will happen there till we get there. But yeah, there's a lot of racism against African footballers like they were in the 1980s and the 1990s. Luckily, it's limited only to certain countries, particularly in Eastern Europe. And unfortunately, it seems also still at the World Cup, not African players specifically, but also players of African descent, where you, Zuniga, who took down Neymar, it is a terrible foul, of course, but he was being called a monkey and so on. So yeah, the stuff is widespread. Even if Yaya Toure makes excuses, it is a big problem. Yes, I think there's a structural problems that are larger than X's and O's when it comes to African teams.
Sean Jacobs, thank you so much for joining us on Dummy. People can follow you on Twitter at Football is a Country. That's part of your website, Africa is a Country, which is obviously meant ironically. Thank you so much again. I really appreciate you joining us on Dummy.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
We'll have links to the Africa is a Country site and the excellent Football is a Country Twitter feed on our website. If you haven't checked them out yet, you should. Time for another quick break. And when we get back, we will take a look into the stands, broader socioeconomic, racial viewership, I guess, of this World Cup in Brazil. Okay, David, I want to ask you, there haven't been all that many black people from Brazil, it seems, watching the games. They seem to have, you know, the crowd seem to have skewed richer, whiter. It's not a true demographic slice of the full spectrum of Brazilian society. What do you make of this?
I think it's really sad. I mean, not only is it not a reflection of the sort of demographics of Brazil, it's not a reflection of the average football crowd in Brazil, which, though it, again, is still sort of skewed, I would say, to, you know, those with money, which means probably that you're white, is still a much more sort of mixed than popular occasion. But this has been, you know, not merely just sort of white and comfortable. Often this has been, you know, the elite have been at these games. And, you know, this has consequences. I mean, we get fantastic singing of the Brazilian national anthem. And, you know, obviously that stirring of a little mawkish, and there's the a cappella piece. But then actually the atmosphere during the games that I've been hearing, there have been long periods of silence, a lot of real kind of nerviness, an incredibly narrow range of singing. And I read and see on the internet, you know, that there have been a whole variety of attempts to teach this bunch of Brazilian football fans some songs to sing. People are handing stuff out. So, you know, that it has consequences. And I also think there's a couple of kind of a nasty streak on occasion. I mean, you've got people abusing and booing President Rousseff at the opening game in pretty kind of unpleasant terms. You've then got the booing of the Chilean national anthem. And the thing that really gets me is, you know, when you've got games where much of the crowd is Brazilian, they're neutrals. When the game kind of dips for a bit, there's a kind of impatience with, like, why am I not being served my sumptuous dinner of football?
Right.
You know, the moment the kind of pace drops. And I find all of those things slightly irksome. I mean, that said, it's worth saying, you know, Brazil is not the only country whose fans do not reflect the real demographic of the country. I mean, you know, Colombians, for example, whose team is, you know, very much Afro-Colombian, perhaps half the squad. Similarly, Ecuadorians, even more so. You're not going to see too many people of color in the crowd. And I suspect the same goes for European fans as well.
That was great. I want to move on now to Tiki Taka as soon as we have this little musical interlude. We're almost out of time, but let's take one moment and wrap this thing up with Tiki Taka. You guys always bring such good stuff to the table. What do you have today, Danny?
So this goes back to, I know we spoke about this, the German camp, I guess, and their the place they were staying throughout the tournament. Well, the Dutch apparently are having to move out of their hotel in Rio because FIFA's executives are moving in. Now, apparently Louis van Gaal and the whole Dutch Federation knew this would be the case before the World Cup, but they're still quite up in arms about it just because of how comfortable they've been having this base throughout the tournament. And now they're having to seek alternate lodging for the semifinal and possibly the final. So I thought that was kind of interesting.
All right. David, how about you?
I'm just going to go with the people of Colombia as my favorite thing of the week. I don't know if you've seen the pictures of the team's return to Bogota, but really, you would have thought they'd won the World Cup rather than just being the losing quarterfinalists. An absolutely amazing display at a really kind kind of interesting moment in Colombia's history on the verge, you know, of finally sorting a peace process after 30 years of narco wars. So I just want to, let's, you know, celebrate the Colombian team who, you know, entertained us royally, and the Colombian people for showing us that it's not actually all about winning.
That's great. Okay. So I want to talk about, I want to go back to Tim Krul and the fact that he was subbed in explicitly to save penalty kicks at the end of the quarterfinal match against Costa Rica. Now, on this, I keep saying I'm not going to do this anymore, but on soccer.fusion.net, the site that I'm editing this summer, we had a really fun piece about the history of coaches using substitute goalkeepers in penalty kick shootouts. And it's never been done in the World Cup, as far as we know, but it has been done in club soccer quite a bit. And it's been successful before. It's been a disaster before. Probably the most disastrous moment that has ever happened because a sub was put into a game is a goalkeeper named Jasmin Fezic. He's a Bosnian goalkeeper. He was on the Bosnian squad for this World Cup, but back in 2012, he was a substitute goalkeeper at Greuther Fürth in Germany. They were playing, their small team, they were playing Borussia Dortmund in the German Cup semifinal. The goalkeeper had spent all season on the bench, but the coach said, you know what, if we get it to penalty kicks, I'm going to put you in. The, what is this team called? Greuther Fürth heroically kept the score goalless up until the 118th minute. And when that happened, the goalkeeper, the first choice goalkeeper who'd played out of his mind, came off. Jasmin Fezic went in, took his place. There's footage of this on YouTube. So I know that when the clock hit 119 minutes and 55 seconds, that's 5 seconds left in extra time, not counting stoppage time, the Borussia Dortmund got the ball. A player at the top of the box hit a shot. It was a volley, hit the post. Fezic was a little late on the dive. He missed it, but the ball hit the post. But he was, as he was sort of still outstretched, the ball rebounded off the post, onto his back, and into the goal. And watching his teammates just collapse on the field after they had done everything they could to keep Borussia Dortmund, a very big team, from scoring all game, is just tragic. Like, it really made my heart hurt for these people.
No. I just hope that boy's got a big therapy fund somewhere.
Oh my God. And the whole town, that, you know, I can imagine that the therapists in Greuther Fürth, if that's the name of the place, really had some good business after that. It was just heartbreaking. But you can see a video of that and read the story on soccer.fusion.net. I highly recommend it. It's amazing. Well, that does it for this episode of Dummy, but don't turn it off just yet. We've been working with EA Sports on a contest. EA Sports makes those FIFA video games, I'm sure you're familiar. They're flying 25 people up to Seattle, putting them up in a hotel, taking them to see the Sounders play Tottenham Hotspur. And here's the really cool part. Those 25 people will be part of a FIFA soccer video game tournament, along with players from both teams. We put the call out on Twitter, on Facebook, in our weekly email bulletin, which you can sign up for right now at howlermagazine.com. We ask for submissions in the form of a minute-long audio clip explaining why we should pick you to go to Seattle. We did that because the winner is going to help us make a new episode of Howler Radio about the experience. The submissions ran the gamut from really nice and earnest,
my older brother taught me everything I know about soccer,
to a little bit evil,
there's no other team in the world I despise more than Tottenham. So if you want to send me to Seattle, do it. Do it. Because I'd love to warmly shake the hand of a Tottenham player while I look him in the eyes and get a chance to call him a cunt.
Whoa. Oh, finally, we settled on a winner, and I'm going to play the audio from that submission in just a second. But before I do, I want you to know that we will be running two more of these contests starting this week. One is for Liverpool-Manchester City, the game they're playing in New York on July 30th. And the other is for the MLS All-Star game in Portland, where the MLS All-Stars will be taking on Bayern Munich. That's happening August 6th. So please follow along with us on Twitter. We are at WhatAHowler for details on how to send in submissions. And you, too, could be playing video games with pro soccer players. Here's our winner, Stephen Whiting.
Good morning, Howler powers it be. This is Stephen Whiting coming to you from a Dillard stock room in Bartlesville, Oklahoma. We've got bargain basement prices on men's footwear, but I'll save it for another time. Honestly, I had prepared 60 seconds of beautiful, detailed, to-the-minute plans of me, Jan Vertonghen, top of the Space Needle. We've got soccer, tennis, assless chaps, bacon and whiskey. But alas, I see now that you don't have a section for that. So quickly now, I'm running out of time, just like Roberto Soldado in front of goal. 20 seconds to go. My experience with FIFA is that is actually how I became a European soccer fan. Leeds United, 2002. I feel like I invested in Enron at the last minute because no team is worse at squandering money than Leeds United as opposed to Tottenham and Seattle. Nothing to show for it. It sucks.
Okay, congratulations to Steven, and I hope that you too will send in a submission for one of the trips we have coming up. Please check our website, howlermagazine.com, for more details. Those will go live later this week. Okay, back to the credits. I want to thank our panelists, David Goldblatt and Danny Carbassian. They've been with us all summer. Sean Jacobs was our guest today. Alexander Abnos has been checking in periodically from Brazil. Thanks also to Slate. The guys at Hang Up and Listen are so great. If you're hearing this podcast through our own feed, the Howler Radio feed, you should go check out the sports podcast that Slate puts out. Josh Levine, Mike Volo, and Andy Bowers have put our podcast in their feed. So you might be hearing this podcast through Slate's feed. If you're doing that, then please come and subscribe to ours. It's Howler Radio. It's in iTunes, wherever else you might listen to podcasts. Most of all, thank you for listening. If you're not following us on Twitter, you should be at WhatAHowler. It's also our name on Instagram. If you want more World Cup stories, check out our radio documentary series. We track down some of the great soccer stories from all over the world, including El Salvador and American Samoa. To right here in 1950s America, you can hear those at howlermagazine.com/radio or in our podcast feed on iTunes. The Howler Singers are led by Lindsay Elliott. They are members of a choral ensemble called Ghostlight, and they made our theme tune. All the rest of the music is by Brian Kim. This podcast was produced by Matthew Nelson with help from Ryan Katniss, Kira Deppenbrock, and Milena Barajas. My name is George Gracie. I'll be back with you on Friday with all the rest of these dummies. Until then, happy World Cup.